I want to say three things.
No more garbage.
The first thing.
Quiet.
The first thing.
It's March 2015, and you're hearing a protest in suburban Toronto. This is a YouTube video, by the way. And Kathleen Wynne is in the middle of it. She's the Premier of Ontario.
What I would like to say is that I know that you are here because you care about your children. I know that.
Now, you may think that she's just sort of walking on by and there's a line of people yelling at her, but it's nothing like that. She's actually surrounded. Surrounded by these angry parents who are really mad at her new sex education curriculum. The parents are holding up these posters that say things like, "My child, my choice." There's a dad just to Kathleen Wynne's right, and he's giving her this intense stare. She's trying to get a word in, but he shouts her down.
Good for nothing. They are hiding in their children.
There are three security guards around Kathleen Wynne, one on her left, one on her right, and there's one directly behind her. And as the crowd gets rowdier and rowdier, you can tell they're a little bit concerned. The crowd starts to sway back and forth, and it actually jostles her a bit. So the guy on her right puts his hand in front of her, and the guy behind her puts his hand on her back to make sure that she doesn't fall down. You gotta think, okay, now it's time to leave. But she doesn't.
Behind other provinces in terms of results that have come from other provinces in terms of teenage pregnancies and sexual assault. We are
It was one of those things where you can kind of tell sometimes when the premier gets up and talks about something that this is a hill that she's willing to die on. You could kind of tell that this was one of them with her.
This is Brian Platt. He reports on politics in Toronto, and he covered the sex ed protests in 2015. She shouted down once again, and then she smirks. She laughs uncomfortably, sort of to say, I can't believe this is happening in 2015.
You know, Ontario has an openly lesbian premier. Like, it's not a place where, you know, you want, it's, nobody wants the Ontario to be a, at least nobody involved in politics, you know, at Queen's Park. Almost nobody, 98% of the people there. They don't want Ontario to be a place where it's like, it's controversial to update a sex ed curriculum.
But it became controversial because that summer, it seemed like anywhere she went, these parents would show up. She kept trying to tell them, listen, your kids need to be informed about sex and sexual health. That's how they can stay safe. That's what the research is telling me.
The changes to the health and physical education curriculum are changes that are based on science. There is a lot of change that has happened.
I'm Gordon Caddick. Today, I'm bringing you a story about the politics of sex education. We're going to Toronto, where those politics are the most intense. You'll hear stories of parents, teachers, and policymakers as they fight over the birds and the bees.
My name is Liba Spring. I'm a sexual health educator.
Liba Spring lives in a big old house with a jungle of plants in her garden. As I showed up, she was gardening. So she sets down her gloves and we sit down.
I grew up with very, very normative ideas about what a girl and woman should be. And part of that was no girl should be like a dirty dish towel that every boy has wiped his dirty hands on. So that was pretty much the sum total of my sexual health education.
Liba has short hair and big earrings hanging low. She kind of looks like a 1960s student radical. Almost the first thing she tells me is that she became a feminist in 1968.
A friend of mine took me to a meeting. At the time, it was called Women's Liberation Movement meeting. And I felt the scales drop from my eyes. I became aware for the first time of gender politics. And because of gender politics, eventually I developed an interest in women's health.
Liba starts working for Toronto Public Health, and they send her into schools to run classes about consent and gender. In one of her first classes, an 11-year-old boy writes her a question. It's a question she's never forgotten, over 30 years later.
In a Catholic school, one of the questions I received was, what happens if you shove a stick in a girl's c***? You may need to bleep that out. And I made the decision to read this question out loud, unexpurgated. And then I looked at the girls who had stiffened in their chairs, and I said, well, let me first ask the girls how you feel about the language in this question. And then they expressed themselves, you know, hurt and so on. And then I explored gender relations. I said,
after the discussion about gender relations, the class ends, and Liba hands out anonymous evaluation forms. How did I do?
You know, I said, you know, write what you like, write what you liked, what you didn't like, write hello, you know, it's fine. And I got an answer from a kid who signed it. The kid signed it Reno.
Do you still have the letter?
I do.
Do you think we could read it?
No, I don't know where the heck it is. Come on, man. I have to go digging. I could probably find it if I dug.
She finds me the letter and brings it down. And I see that it's faded foolscap, covered in this kind of childish scrawl. This definitely was written by an 11-year-old a long time ago.
Okay, would you like me to read this?
Sure.
Okay, Monday, June 2nd, 1986. It's titled, What I Think. I thought the puberty class was great, although I knew it all.
He's pretty confident. He knew it all.
Oh, yeah. I thought sex was just going to get a girl and grabbing a girl and having sex and leaving. I was wrong. Now I know what to do with my girlfriend. You should not use them because they are humans just like me. I think I'm going to weep. I've learned more about our testicles and about the female body. One day I thought it was boring, and that was all. By Reno F.
Can we go back to that line?
Yeah, sure. I was wrong.
I was wrong, and now I know what to do.
What to do with my girlfriend.
You should not use them because they are humans just like me. Mm-hmm. How did that make you feel when you first saw that?
Well, I don't remember the feeling that I had, but looking at it now, and every time I think about it, I get goosebumps because it's so profound, and it's just, it has to do with the basis of how we relate to each other, and to think that what I did in a classroom made a young person, I mean, he was only 11 years old, and I made him rethink his whole cosmos, his whole idea of what the world was like and what human relations were like. It was just, it had an incredible effect on me.
I'm standing in front of a nondescript brick building. It looks like a small factory. When I walk upstairs, I reach a kind of repurposed industrial space turned into an open concept office. It's just like a media startup. But this is the Interim. It's been around since 1983, and it's a pro-life, family values newspaper. I sit in the waiting area, and I notice a little plastic figurine fetus. It's next to a bookshelf with a megaphone on top of it. Jack Fonseca walks up and introduces himself.
My name is Jack Fonseca, and I work full-time here at Campaign Life Coalition, which is a national pro-life and pro-family nonprofit organization that works to advance life and family values.
He takes me over to a meeting space, and there are these shelves that run all along the wall, and they're filled with those big three-ring binders. You know, those thick, like, two-inch ones? And on the spine of each binder, there's a different issue listed on it. Assisted suicide, abortion, celibacy, marriage and family, sex education. This may very well be the Canadian headquarters of the conservative Christian right.
We're in downtown Toronto, which is near Yonge and Dundas. That's where the national headquarters is. And there are also provincial offices across Canada, but this is the headquarters.
The first thing that strikes me about Jack is how clean cut he is. Sharp dresser, short hair, little side part, very clean shaven. Exactly like what you think a conservative Christian would look like.
I have two children in the Catholic school system here in Ontario, and age 6 and 4, so they're in kindergarten and JK. And so this sex ed curriculum hits close to home for my family because starting next year in grade one, next September, they'll presumably be exposed to the to these sex ed lessons.
As I'm sure you're already guessing, Jack does not agree with the liberal sex education plans. He doesn't even think these plans are about health and safety.
The signals from the government and from activist teachers who are on video make it clear that's not the agenda at all. It's not about respect or anti-bullying. It's about eradicating the religious beliefs of traditionally principled families, and that's what they're going to do. That's not appropriate.
So this is a revolutionary document to you?
It's totally revolutionary. The whole, it's extremely ideological and radical and revolutionary, this document, the sex ed program. Not once in 244 pages, never once does it mention the words love or marriage in relation to the sex ed component. This is not at all about true sexual health. This is about sexual liberation. This is about teaching children that sex is a recreational activity. It's something that's totally about pleasure, has nothing to do with love or marriage or procreation or creating a family. And the
can I interrupt you for a sec? No, I actually brought it. I was wondering. I couldn't print it because it was going to cost me $37 to print. but I brought it on an iPad, and I wanted to just kind of go through it with you.
I asked Jack to go through the curriculum with me. He pulls open a little flyer on his computer, and he picks out 5 or 6 quotes.
So here's telling the teacher what topics will be discussed in grade 3. So C3.3, describe how visible differences, example skin, hair, other stuff, and invisible differences, example learning abilities, skills and talents, gender identity, sexual orientation, and other things make each person unique. So they're this is telling the teacher that gender identity is to be discussed in grade 3. And the theory of gender identity, which you can find in the Ministry of Education's definition, is the belief that gender is fluid, like water, that a little boy might actually be a little girl in his mind. It's a university-level gender theory course that's being shoved down at a grade 3 level.
Do you think they'll
and very
they'll,
radical?
Do you think they'll go that far? Because I mean, I'm looking at what the prompt says, and there's examples of what a teacher could say to illustrate C3.3, and the prompt says, "How can you be a role model and show respect for differences in other people?"
Yeah, absolutely, they'll go that far.
I don't see a university-level gender theory course. I see a vague message of tolerance. But Jack says they're hiding their true goals. He takes me through each of his passages, and every time it goes kind of like this. You know, Gordon, there's more here. Just read between the lines.
It's C1.5.
Great. Yeah. Could you read it?
So it introduces. Now it does it in a way that under the guise of talking about STDs, so it makes it sound innocuous when they introduce the topic of anal and oral sex to 12-year-olds.
If you followed the media coverage of these protests, you probably heard this a lot. The protesters have not read the document. But that is simply not true, at least not for Jack. And I've actually called lots of other people that disagree with the document, and they've all read it. but they've read it in the way that Jack reads it.
I believe they realized they had to be somewhat sneaky and put this under the guise of discussing sexually transmitted diseases. But what they're really doing is introducing the topics of anal and oral sex to a group of 12-year-olds and 13-year-olds who perhaps have never seriously considered that these are activities they could be engaged in right now until the teacher brings it up and mentions it. It's about planting these ideas in the minds of children so that all their sexual choices are available for them to make.
Other journalists that have covered this have described the very same phenomenon, the thing that you're hearing now with me and Jack. Two people looking at the same passage, but seeing two wildly different things.
So I'm not saying I don't believe you, but Jack, my question is, if the values they're expressing are the values that you're saying that they're expressing in this document, why aren't they more forthright about it? Why do we have to read the tea leaves?
Because they're like clever socialists. They don't want to give away the agenda. Because
do you think they'll find out that your kid comes home and says they taught me how to have fun with anal play? Like, you're going to find out if that happens.
Well, it's not just the explicit stuff. It's the more subtle lessons that will leave the impression with children that, hey, I'm expected to have sex. The school expects that I'm having sex. I'm going to consider maybe starting to have sex.
Now, I have a theory for why this is happening. We can quibble about the odd passage or two, but I think that's all beside the point. What is undeniable is that this document acknowledges the existence of premarital sex, homosexuality, masturbation, even pornography, and it doesn't condemn those things. Jack is fighting for a different Canada, and this document thinks that that Canada has passed, if it ever existed in the first place. So when you look at the boring sex ed curriculum within that context, that kind of grand cultural battle that Jack is fighting, it's easy to see how you start to read things into the subtext. The document becomes a kind of proxy. And Jack, must feel under attack because this country is stepping away from his conservative Christian values. Well, except maybe not.
This week is a shocking week because Ontario's premier has launched his new sex education program.
This is Charles McVitie. He's a televangelist, and you're hearing his television show in 2010. He's very, very mad at Dalton McGuinty. That's the former premier of Ontario who rolled out his sex education curriculum in 2010.
That starts with grade 3, teaching horrific things like sexual orientation, same-sex marriage, and gender identity. The end result will be that our little boys and girls are going to start questioning their gender.
And the media loved this guy. They gave him a ton of coverage.
That's Liba again, and she's right. Charles McVitie was all over the news. As I did research on this, his name popped up everywhere. Charles McVitie, Charles McVitie, Charles McVitie, Charles McVitie. But Liba, she won't even say his name.
I sat across the table from him on a television program that's well known in Ontario, Steve Paikin's Agenda. And this guy, I don't even want to say his name.
Charles McVitie.
Never mind. So he was across the table from me. And, we argued it out the best way we could.
Charles makes this his hobby horse. He starts a campaign
called Stop CorruptingChildren.ca.
And he riles parents up. They tell their MPs.
So one day I was being scrummed by the media and somebody asked me about our new revisions to the sexual health curriculum.
That's Dalton McGuinty, former premier of Ontario.
I was caught in a position no political or government leader wants to be caught in, which is, I knew nothing about this. And I quickly came to the conclusion that we got it wrong. You know, there's an old leadership axiom. You can only lead with the consent of the led. And we had clearly put the cart before the horse. We had not consulted.
Okay, but Dombrowski was out on the Wednesday making the argument that consultation had happened.
You're hearing that, Sam, my co-producer. He's grilling Dalton on this because Leba and some of the other proponents say that actually there was a lot of consultation. They say that what happened was a radical fringe got Dalton scared.
That in fact, the education ministry had received 3,000 responses from the public after submitting a draft.
That was insufficient. This was not contemplating changes to the English curriculum, the geography curriculum, the history curriculum, or the math curriculum. This is sexual health.
Dalton pulled it back 3 days later.
It's become pretty obvious to us that that we should give this a serious rethink.
I just want to stop for a second and acknowledge how unbelievable that is. When is the last time you remember a politician abandoning a major policy after 3 days?
I was pissed off, not just as a sexual health educator, but as a citizen of the province of Ontario. I was outraged that he had let himself be browbeaten into this position because of political expediency. You know, he just lay down and died. It was just disgusting.
It felt great that, you know, this corruption of childhood innocence was stopped. This radical curriculum was stopped in its tracks and shelved. So as a parent, at the time, as a young parent whose children were not school aged and one of the children wasn't even born yet, it felt good.
The people who want this sex education curriculum say that there's just nothing controversial here. It provides kids the basic information about their body and how to stay safe. And the old curriculum, it hasn't been updated since 1998. That's before social media was a big part of what it's like to be a kid. So an update had to happen. And, you know, much of the medical, political, and academic community, they were strongly behind it. So even though Dalton McGuinty scrapped it, you had to think this will come back. And it did, 5 years later.
Good for nothing. They are hiding in their chamber.
And here we are back again where we started, with that angry dad shouting down Kathleen Wynne. But you'll notice something. This dad doesn't sound like Jack. He's not a white guy, and I don't think he's Catholic either.
Anybody who went to the protest could see it right away. This was heavily dominated by immigrant communities, by ethnic communities.
Again, political reporter Brian Platt.
Lots and lots of Muslim groups, South Asian groups, Eastern European groups.
All communities say
no.
All women say
no.
All religions say
no.
These were groups, I mean, they seemed for the most part to be organized around their church, their, you know, place of worship. And, but they were groups that I think normally were not really engaged in sort of political speech, you know, within their own communities potentially, but not in the larger mainstream.
We are here today because we are the parents that pulled our children out of the school system. We decided to come here with our children today to show Kathleen Wynne that we are in charge. We are the parents and we are the main educators. As you can see, there are people of many different ethnic backgrounds, religions. We are all here together with one voice saying the same thing. We want a choice.
And so it really felt like you were seen a political movement being forged. And the thing that made it really difficult was that on one hand you want marginalized communities to find a way to have a political voice. But in this case, it was them using that voice to protest, you know, a curriculum that most people really thought was important to have in place.
So if you consider that at the time of the controversy last year over sex education, Stephen Harper, then prime minister, was campaigning for re-election on a promise to ban the niqab.
This is Lauren Bialystok. She's at the University of Toronto, and she studies the philosophy and ethics of education. She does not agree with the protesters, but she understands why they are mad. She thinks if we had a more inclusive society, maybe they wouldn't be so defensive.
Is it any wonder that some of the most visible and most vocal protesters of the curriculum were recent immigrants of Muslim faith who felt very excluded from their newly joined community? I can only sympathize with their feelings of exclusion and worry over the Islamophobic tenor of some of the public discourse.
In the first case, you had an already politically savvy and mobilized group of people, evangelicals and conservative Catholics. They used the traditional methods of politics to change the mind of a premier. In 2015, you had a new group of people that weren't already politically tapped in, like evangelicals and Catholics. So they took to the street. And people responded very differently.
If you look at some of the editorials and some of the discourse in the media last year, you see that the sex education curriculum in many ways became a proxy for a larger debate about national identity.
Here's a clip I think that sort of illustrates this. It's from a CBC radio program.
We've seen a real change in terms of who lives in this province, in terms of who lives in this city. Do you think that we should... As a general society should change the curriculum based on the cultures and the values of those who arrive here?
The media narrative kind of takes on this nuanced philosophical conversation about pluralism and Canadian identity.
The Catholic school board or the representatives of the Catholic school boards who opposed the curriculum never had their Canadianness called into question. They were allowed to say exactly the same things about homosexuality, about gender fluidity, about premarital sex, without having their national identity called into question.
Kathleen Wynne did not back down. Is that because the protests were largely Muslim? It's hard to say. And as Brian already said, Kathleen Wynne clearly believes in this strongly. So probably she still would have gone ahead with it. But it is an interesting question. And going forward, you have to kind of look at this because it wasn't enough on sex education. But what will this new political bloc do? Let's not get too lost in the politics. What does sex ed actually look like? And what can it mean for a student? After the break, I talked to a Catholic teacher. He now teaches sex ed, but he said he got bad sex ed as a kid, and he spent 20 years trying to fix the damage. Back in 1 minute.
And here's a story about being free.
I'm a 30-year-old secondary teacher. I grew up in North York, and now I teach in Scarborough.
He teaches in a Catholic school,
and his mom
is on the school board.
Do you want to get into my hobbies?
He has a secret that he's been hiding from her, a secret he's held onto for over 30 years. He's got a plan, though. He's going to take her out to lunch, and he's going to finally tell her.
And it wasn't until we had like finished the meal and we're in the parking lot that I kind of just said, hey, this is why I wanted to go for lunch with you. And so I never really, the one thing you learn is there's no real segue to talk about sexual abuse, right? So it's, and what I learned later on is like, that's the only way to start telling people is to say,
when Brian was 11 years old, he was sexually abused. He finally tells his parents.
And it was hard for them at first, for sure. It was definitely a shock. Like, but my mom was extremely
quiet
at
the time,
everything
and she
was
happened.
Very.
He doesn't give
like,
any.
You can tell she
like,
was very
who did it or
distraught
how did
over
it happen. So can you imagine being Brian's mom? Your son tells you this terrible thing, but he's not going to open up about it.
And I think that's what also prompted me to write my story.
He wrote a letter,
down.
And
it's a lot easier
it
to
Facebook.
Write out certain things than to like sit and talk about it. Well, the initial time it took, I wrote everything down. I wrote about 8,000 words in a day. For it was a Sunday, and I wrote it like for it must have been about 12 hours. I took a couple breaks, but it was very exhausting, and like I said, it was very cathartic.
So, would you care to read some of it for me?
Sure. Do you want me to start from the beginning here? Or?
Yeah, if you want to just start from...
I was sexually abused between the ages of 11 and 12 years old. I was preyed upon
by, the
by
way,
an older, popular guy in the neighborhood
you're not hearing
who manipulated me into satisfying his desires with the promise of money. I remember the silence. I never said a word during the abuse. I remember his cologne.
This was a popular kid in the neighborhood. Somebody Brian really did want
to please. I remember the pictures of fruit baskets on the terrible wallpaper.
And this kid gave Brian money, too. And Brian thought, that's great. I can buy a PlayStation. And what do I have to do? That's it?
It didn't seem like a big deal. I was 11. I was naive. My understanding of sex came from PG movies.
I guess transitioning a little bit, but what do you think sex ed has to do with this story? Like, do you remember anything, any specific classes or teachers and the kinds of things that they were telling you about sexuality at the time?
We had something called Fully Alive in Ontario, which for the in the Catholic system, and it's very vague. It was very like about friendship and making sure that you love each other and that, you know, sex before marriage and all that kind of stuff. I don't even remember hearing the word penis until probably high school. I just understood, to me, my whole understanding of love was like Disney based, right? It was, you know, Beauty and the Beast. It was like Full House.
What do you think, what would you have wished to have heard from a teacher specifically? Like what could have a teacher said that made a difference?
Yeah, I thought about that a lot actually. And for me, I think that I, like, at the very least, understanding that, you know, this is your body, you know, you, as a male, you have a penis. The penis is part of reproduction. It's also extremely important to you as a human being, as your identity and how you value yourself. It is a very sacred thing. And, you know, there was never a discussion, like, our understanding of sexuality at the age that I was abused was very much like understanding vague notions of love between man and woman and God. And, you know, there might have been something about breast milk.
All right. You can take it from he said he had it.
He said he had it. He would give it to me after I kissed him once. The abuse never involved kissing before, so it jarred me. That's what I understood as intimacy. The other stuff was confusing and uncomfortable, but I knew kissing was something you did with someone you loved. I know this because the moment he tried, I pushed him off. I remember vividly how it ended. He grabbed me hard, harder than the other times. Something inside of me screamed, and I threw him against the wall. I left him there and never came back.
Why do you think it was the kiss?
I think for me, like I said, it was the first time that during that whole, during the abuse that I understood what was happening to me. And I distinctly, like, as much as it was difficult to go back over the memories, and it was very difficult when I was writing that aspect or section of the sort of memoir. But when I went back, I remember the room that it happened in. I remember exactly the moment that it was over, because it's burned into my memory. I remember, like, there was some attempt at kissing me, and I just grabbed him and threw him against the wall. And I think that might have been the first memory that I acknowledged when I was around 25, when I said to myself, or when I acknowledged that, you know what, something happened to me, and I need to look over it, and I need to deal with it.
Brian continues on in the letter, and he writes about how he lived his next 20 years in denial. He did not really accept the facts of what happened to him and what effect it had on him, so he would just kind of act out. He ate too much, he drank too much, and he got angry. And maybe hardest of all, he really struggled with trust and intimacy. Whenever anyone got close, he would retract. All of his relationships broke apart. And one day he broke up with a woman that he really, really liked. This is actually the first woman he told about the abuse. So she came over to talk one day after they had broken up, and she opened up about how Brian's issues really hurt her.
When she told me about all the suffering I caused her, then I finally had to acknowledge I was broken. That night, she gave me the greatest gift anyone could give me, the truth. The truth of how my actions had serious, painful, and ugly consequences. That I wasn't just hurting myself, but the people who loved me and least deserved it. I cried deeply for the first time since I was abused. I cried for the 11-year-old boy who just wanted to play hockey and learn how to play drums. I cried to speak to him, to tell him that I didn't need him to be strong anymore. That it wasn't his fault. That I'll never blame him again. That he didn't need to hide it all away anymore. I cried to reach out and hug the shame out of him, because he was a good kid with a good heart. I still have rage inside, but now it comes when I see attempts to silence or censor sexual education in our public schools. I'm a living example that we need more dialogue around sexual health, not less. We also need to teach our boys there are emotions other than anger. That it isn't a sign of weakness to tell your friends or family when you're hurting. That reaching out to your parents, a teacher, or friends isn't weak. That it's brave to ask for help. We have to rethink how to educate our boys. They need to understand what true strength is. To be tough enough to talk.
It's interesting, like, the message I'm hearing is kind of like, we need to have a conversation, we need to be more open about this, personally in your own story, but also just in talking about sexual education. It's interesting because I think a big argument that the opponents to sex education bring up is too much too soon. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, like, I can just use that same line and say I was sexually abused too much too soon. You know what I mean? Like, it's very easy to refute that, because, you know, we're talking 1 in 6 boys, and in women, 1 in 4, right? So it's not an insignificant number. Because I look at myself and I look at all the survivors that I've met and talked to, and every one of us would say, you know what, I could go for an awkward conversation in an afternoon. You know, I can deal with the fact that, you know what, there's giggling and, you know, oh, this is too much for me. I feel like my innocence is lost. I'm like, yeah, my innocence was lost too. Like, my innocence was lost, and for 20 years, I hated myself. You know, for 20 years, I dealt with all the problems of my life with avoidance and alcoholism, you know? So when people say it's too much too soon, they're losing their innocence, it makes me laugh in a very angry way, so I don't yell. And, like, Yeah, so that's how I feel about it, I guess.